I don't know about you, but whenever I hear Ness and Dormer, the hairs on the back of my neck still stand on end. I'm Mark Godfrey. Hello again. We're going to kick off episode 5 of Vincerà, not with our roundup of the day's action, that'll come later, but by speaking to the man who was instrumental in Luciano Pavarotti's rendition of Puccini's classic aria being chosen as the theme tune to the BBC's now iconic and fondly remembered Italia 90 TV coverage, opening and closing sequences. My special guest is Philip Burney, who is now head of TV sport for the BBC. Thanks very much for coming onto the show to share some of your memories, Philip. How are you?
Very good. Pleasure to be with you.
Great. So before we actually come on to Ness and Dormer itself, in terms of the standards and amount of TV coverage of the World Cup finals, Italia 90 was going to be on a much grander scale than anything that had gone before. So I presume the pressure to get the imagery and production values just right in order to really grab viewers' attention and, of course, get one over on your rivals at ITV must have been something that occupied everyone's thinking at the BBC in the build-up to the tournament.
Yes, there was a lot of excitement about it. I mean, people might forget that then Italy was the epicentre of the football world. It was, you might say, a forerunner to what the Premier League is now, or the Premier League and La Liga. Most of the great players of the world gravitated towards Italy. So Maradona, for example, was playing for Napoli, with a couple of Brazilians. Inter Milan had the kind of base of the German team with the Klinsmann and Mateus. So Italy was really flourishing in a very, very Serie A was a very, very powerful force. So there was a lot of noise about the World Cup coming to this kind of centrifugal force of world football, and a lot of excitement about it. And yes, from the previous World Cup in Mexico in 86, this was obviously bang in the right time zone as well, which was great for audiences. And there was a huge amount of excitement about it, and a heck of a lot of preparation too. We were then, that's changed a lot since then, of course, how we present. We were then presenting largely from our studios in London as opposed to being on site, that we were on site for a couple of games. So it was a kind of different feel to where football's now got to, but it certainly was the biggest football event at that stage.
So tell us how Ness and Dormer first wormed its way into your consciousness, because it certainly didn't fit the pattern or style of theme music from previous World Cup tournament coverage. And what was it about that particular aria versus any other that convinced you that that was the one?
I'd heard it. I think it was, I don't know, it's something like Desert Island Discs or some sort of I vaguely remember some, I can't remember exactly what, some Sunday morning, perhaps it was Desert Island Discs. I heard this wonderful piece of music, and it really affected me. And I thought it was Pavarotti singing it. What an astonishing aria, what an astonishing piece of music. And it was around that time, this was in the autumn of 89. I was about to go and do a sort of quite a long film we did then, about half an hour, around the Italians' preparation for the World Cup, and in fact involved going to see Napoli play Inter Milan with the stars like Maradona and Carreca and Mateus and Klinsmann. And I went to see that in Napoli, and it was an incredible event with Napoli were then the champions, and the noise in the stadium, the whole feel of the place was unbelievable. When I came back, in terms of kind of climaxing that film, but also for the draw for the 1990 World Cup, which was following soon afterwards, we were preparing various pieces of kind of key videotape. And one of the abiding images I had of Italian football was Tardelli scoring the winning goal. It was the key goal, actually, in the 82 World Cup final, Italy against West Germany, as then was. And running away, it's a very famous celebration, he's running away with his arms flailing and his mouth absolutely agape. And it just struck me that there was a really good collision we could make between the imagery of that incredibly ecstatic moment when you've scored the key on the World Cup final, and Pavarotti singing the kind of climax to Ness and Dormer, the famous when he goes Vincerò, which of course means I will win. And that was the kind of initial motivation for that particular juncture of music and video that I thought would work really effectively. So that was the kind of genesis of it, hearing the music, being really inspired by it, doing this film in Italy, and then coming to the draw where we had we wanted a kind of climactic piece of videotape, and that was what I thought would be the kind of key climactic bit of videotape and sound to go with it, was to have Pavarotti singing it to match Tardelli's ecstatic celebration. So that was when it was first used, and off the back of that, then others got involved. Des Lineram was a big advocate for it being our theme tune as well, because obviously it takes a few people to decide what they want to use for a theme tune. Brian Barwick was the editor of Football, then he later went on to big roles at BBC ITV and the FA. So it was a collision of people working together, deciding that this bit of music, which that was its origins in terms of our using it, should become the theme tune. And you're right, it was quite a radical departure. I think Des was very good and strong in terms of saying, no, this was really different and brave and something we should be doing, so he played a significant part in it too. And I thought it was a brilliant choice, and I thought it was very apposite and very stirring and very emotional, obviously real Italian feel to it as well, but it worked incredibly well. And there was people forget now, because obviously music and the use of music has moved on quite a lot since then, but then you tended to use kind of manufactured music quite a lot for sporting theme tunes, so to go for something out of an opera did feel a pretty radical departure, but it did feel in tune with what the World Cup symbolised in terms of all great things Italian, and as I say, particularly matching up the emotion that the Italians display in their football. And that Tardelli image was again used. It's, I think, the best bit of the titles actually was used with the climactic bit of Pavarotti singing Vincerò, when we did use the title. So that was the absolute kind of key matching of music and pictures.
I understand Luciano Pavarotti's record company actually had some initial objections to the track being used, obviously before it became hugely successful and gave them the green light to release it as a single. I'm sure they would have regretted it hugely had they decided against being able to let you use the music for the titles.
Yeah, it's a long time ago, let's not forget. And I think it's different sort of, as I said, it wasn't that common to take a really well-known piece of music and use it for titles. There's all kinds of music copyright issues and licensing issues, and music companies were and publishing companies were quite protective of that. I understand why, and I think and they weren't used to that request, I think. So initially there was a kind of furrowed brow, not sure about it, how much they might want to charge, but anyway, the good news is they were won over, and to be fair, they pretty rapidly recognised what an absolute boon it was for that performance and that recording. And of course it became a massive hit. Amazing, it became a massive hit. I think it was number one, it was just incredible, the takeoff for it. It was helped by the fact that they did the three tenors concert just ahead of the World Cup as well, with Placido Domingo Carreras as well, so there was quite a lot of noise around up at the time, but definitely using it, the regularity of using it around for every program that we did had a really positive impact, and the record company were delighted about it. By the end of it, they were sort of incredibly complimentary and thrilled with the way it worked for them.
Well, we know that Pavarotti was a football fan himself. Did you ever actually get to find out what his thoughts were about the whole phenomenon? And that's probably how I would describe it, because every sort of audiovisual signature to World Cup coverage since 1990 has strived to match or top what you did back then, and I'm not convinced that it's yet to be done.
It's quite difficult, really, because and I've been involved in some other ones as well, right? This I think was just a particularly successful marriage of sound and vision, and with an incredibly resonant piece of music, and that is quite hard to replicate. There's been some very good tunes used by us and others since, of course, but it's this just really hit home. Not least as you were saying, because it was quite a departure from what we're used to, seeing. In terms of Pavarotti's own reaction, unfortunately, I didn't see him because I was based in London. I was editing some of the programmes, and I wasn't out in Italy, alas. But we did send a crew actually, and they did do a piece with Luciano Pavarotti, and I think he was delighted with it. He was absolutely thrilled. I mean, I think it certainly helped his sales. So he was very complimentary and warm about it when they did the piece. So as you'd expect him to be, he was really excited about the way it had taken off in the UK.
Yeah, the popularity of Ness and Dorma and the BBC's coverage really opened up opera and classical music to an audience that previously perhaps felt that it really wasn't for them. And you mentioned the series of three tenors concerts, and here in the UK, the classic FM radio station would soon begin broadcasting nationally after that. And if we look back at the intervening 30 years, sort of classical and operas acquired this veneer of youth and cool about it. I would argue that it's a direct result of that. Would you agree?
It's interesting. You sort of just pick a piece of music out, and the kind of long tail that it produces is very interesting. So I had a couple of academics make that sort of connection, the thesis dating back to this choice of this piece of music for that event. I don't know. I think it definitely had some clear benefits to Pavarotti, but also to classical music, and sort of introduce people to classical music. And I love classical music myself, alongside popular music, by the way. But so I was very happy to see that happen. I mean, the level to which he kind of fired off greater interest, I don't know. I mean, others can make that call. But I was really happy to see how well it worked. I was really happy to see that people therefore engaging in opera and brilliant singing of the kind Pavarotti and classical music generally. So it's been really that was very heartwarming. But how this connects to the wider interest in classical music is hard to say.
I mean, you mentioned that you were back in the studio editing a lot of the coverage. Do you actually get an opportunity, whether it's at Italia 90 or other major tournament or Olympic Games, for example, do you get an opportunity to enjoy the whole experience, or are you just simply work through the whole thing?
Well, it depends on role. I had different again, this is going back a long time, so I had different roles. At that stage I was basically the assistant editor to Brian Barwick, who's the editor of the football. So I was editing some of the programmes and putting some of the videotape packages together in a sort of the bunker of Television Centre, as then was. This was back in 1990. As time has gone on, I've been lucky enough to go to other World Cups and be whilst working hard and looking after events, I haven't the chance to go to actually the odd match here and there. And definitely from 1998, actually, when we went out to France and based ourselves in Paris, we tended on the whole to base ourselves where possible if there was a properly iconic place to present from in the cities, like Moscow most recently in 2018 for the Russian World Cup. And there you can certainly enjoy the atmosphere, and you're in the heart of it. You're right by the Kremlin for that one, so you get the whole sense of not only the Russians enjoying, but international fans coming to and fro. So that was a great experience. And then, as I say, lucky enough to go to a couple of games too. So, yeah, I've been very fortunate to be able to savour some of the best parts of World Cups, as well as be equally fortunate in terms of being involved with the outputs and programmes.
And finally, I imagine that World Cups and Olympic Games are landmarks by which you mark your professional life, coming as they do every 2 years or so. Where would you rank Italia 90 for you personally in terms of its importance, but also as a new benchmark in the industry?
Well, I think both for me and for English football, it was really significant. For me, obviously, I was then quite new into the profession, and it was the first time I'd actually been involved in editing programmes at a major event. So it was a real first for me, and I loved it and carried on doing that for some number of years afterwards. So for me, it was a really important point in my career. And then, of course, as you say, the kind of involvement in Ness and Dorma and getting that into such a central place of our coverage was incredibly heartwarming and seeing the whole reaction out of it. So I felt very I was very pleased with the way that it all turned out for me professionally. And then as a World Cup, of course, until we came to Russia 2018, it was the only time in my memory, very, very, very young, when England won the World Cup in 66. It was a World Cup, it was the only time England had been to a semi at a World Cup until last year. And from a time which has been pretty well documented, where English football was in a really poor and difficult way, with real problems with hooliganism and the Hillsborough disaster, there was it had been a really tough time. Football was not really flourishing. So to go from that to this great celebration of England doing so well, and the football being played in Italy, as I say, which was the fulcrum of world football at that time, was wonderful. It wasn't all great football, by the way. I think the football tailed off somewhat, so there was some fairly stolid football being played in the tournament, but the atmosphere around it was great. England's progress in the semis was terrific. They were very unlucky indeed not to have made it through to the final, and you know, we played Argentina there. There was a whole sort of narrative going on there, which would have been really interesting. So it was a great World Cup in many ways, not least for that progress of England and the sense of being in a, you know, spectacular country, which was the very centre of football world at that stage. And as I said, professionally for me, it was a real delight too.
Do you ever still listen to Ness and Dorma and think back to those days?
For a long time, no, to be honest. And I hear it occasionally. And no, I mean, I love it. It's wonderful. I think it's a wonderful piece of music. I'm not an opera buff, and I'd like classical music. This was, as I said earlier, it was a happenstance. It sort of, I came across it, and then it fitted what I wanted to do around the World Cup. But no, so I'm not a regular listener to opera. So I can't listen to it regularly, but it always puts a smile on my face and makes me very warm whenever I do hear it. It's a wonderful piece of music.
Well, Philip Burney, it's been an absolute privilege to have you on. Many thanks for the interview and also giving us so many of our best memories from Italia 90.
It's an absolute pleasure.
So, there you go. The man whose genius idea it was to use an aria about the attempts of a love-struck prince to woo his princess while trying to avoid her having him beheaded. Sounds much better in Italian. With me to talk more about the impact of Ness and Dorma, I have with me Jeff Livingston, founder of the hugely influential and brilliant football blog In Bed with Maradona. All right, Jeff?
Hi, good to be here.
Fantastic. And joining Jeff, I have writer and author of a number of books, chiefly about Tottenham Hotspur, Martin Cloak. How are you, Martin?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having me on. Good to meet you both again.
Excellent. Pleasure to have you both. So, Ness and Dorma and that particular 1972 performance by Luciano Pavarotti is undeniably special, and the way Philip and the creative brains at the BBC married that with those dreamy, nostalgic clips for the Italia 90 coverage was inspired. However, it's not really the music that conjures up the emotions inside any of us when we hear it, is it? Well, it certainly isn't for me anyway.
I think sort of thinking back to those days, it's difficult to sort of put a lot of it in perspective now. I know a lot's been talked about that, the kind of the cultural side of football, but you know, football wasn't as massive a thing then, oddly enough, as it is now. But also Italian football was quite exotic at the time, and I think, you know, there was that it was, I think it was even before people hipsters, wasn't it, but you were kind of into football, that you knew that Italy was where it was, and so there was this kind of exotic thing there. And I think listening to that interview with Philip Burney, I mean, he kind of taps into that, doesn't he? He says that they were looking for something that was a little bit different, a little bit special. And they'd started recognising that there was maybe a little bit of a change going on with the audience of football and with what people are looking at. So, and I think that you know, that music, it did set it apart from anything that had gone on before, because a lot of the musical choices that went to accompany football were fairly predictable. You know, maybe you'd say a little bit cheesy as well. So that was immediately something that it said it was classy without being pretentious at the time, I think, but it was just very different. So there was this immediate signal, I think, wasn't there?
Yeah, I would go along with that as well. And sort of my recollection of going into Italia 90 was, you know, okay, it was a very different world. And I think what we all kind of have to remember is that, you know, this was kind of just a year on from Hillsborough. And, you know, throughout the 1980s, football fans had really been treated, I would say, as second-class citizens, but even that probably sounds a little bit kind of lofty. Football was a game that, you know, was widely sort of considered as something for kind of, you know, nothing more than hooligans. And the transition at that point, and the fact that it was in Italy as well, as kind of Philip has mentioned, this was in the pre-Premier League days, this was the elite competition, the elite league competition. And we didn't, at that stage, we didn't have the connection with the Italian football that Channel 4 would bring in the years to come. So if you like, the only real chance that we got to see some of these European or some of these global superstars, if memory serves me correctly, would be on Sports Night on the BBC on a Wednesday night, and they would quite often dip into the European Cup, which at that time English clubs were still banned from. So we were able to see some of these players at Milan and Inter. So going into Italia 90, there was maybe a little bit of a palpable sense that there was an opportunity here. This was a chance to see Maradona and Hullet and Van Basten and all these other kind of stars as well. So there was definitely something there about the timing.
I think there was, but I think what's interesting is that, you know, as I remember it, I think it was the last time that I really remember going into a big tournament with that sense that football was this niche thing. And I was part of that. And I remember, you know, in the run-up to the World Cup, because, you know, everybody wasn't as into football as they are now, and it wasn't as all-pervasive. And so we said, this is our thing, you know, we're football fans. And I think I think particularly blokes have that kind of, you want to be in a gang, you want to be in a group, don't you, as well? And that was the thing that we did. And we're all regular matchgoers, and we're all really into a game. We had a mate of ours who was going over for the group games with the England Travel Club. So there was kind of, you know, a few sessions in the pub beforehand, and, you know, what we're going to do. We did things. We arranged. We said, well, we'll watch this game at Jim's house, and then we'll go around to Julian's and watch that game. And we almost had it planned out, right? You know, how are we going to consume the tournament? But it was our thing at the time, and it wasn't something that everybody was talking about. And you're right, Jeff, you know, that you didn't have that regular access to players. So some of it was a treat. You know, it was a little bit like, you know, suddenly you've been taken out for this fantastic dinner where you get kind of like loads of all your favourite things all served up at the same time, because you never really got that regular access. You didn't see those players every week on a highlights package on a cable channel or something like that. So this was our thing that we did, which a lot of people didn't understand, and we took some pride in that. There's almost that kind of like elite thing, you know, like when you see the band for the first time, and then when everybody else gets into them after they release the first album, you say, oh, well, I was there at the first gig, you know, they've gone off the boil now. So there's a certain amount of elitism about it, I think, as well. But there was a sense that it was special, that, you know, we got this four-week period when all those things we really liked and all those players we talked about were going to be, you know, we could see them regularly on TV, and you couldn't do that all the time. And there's an argument now, you know, that have we had too much of a good thing, because you can see football pretty much every day of the week, pretty much anywhere you are, and how special is it anymore, you know, which is possibly a different discussion. But I think that this tournament was the last time that we had that sense that it was something special, it was something that wasn't every day, and it was something that was ours. And we were another in a way that Jeff said, that we were seen as hooligans and the great unwashed or whatever, but we were also another in that we had that passion for it that other people didn't really understand, and we really valued that.
Nessun Dorma was just one of a number of things, and I suppose you mentioned in there, Martin, about football being a niche and not the phenomenon that it is now, that everybody knows it, everybody sees it every day on the TV. It was just another one of those things, along with Nessun Dorma, that chimed into that zeitgeist of the summer of 1990. A lot of these we're going to discuss in future episodes, but briefly, it was a key element that helped to stir us as a nation to fall in love with football again, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it was. I mean, I don't know what it was that really did that. You know, people talk about this, they talk about fever pitch, you know, being issued, and, you know, was it that football became popular because the people who were supposedly in the right places, the cultural commentators and the, you know, the arbiters of the zeitgeist got into it as well. But Obviously, you know, the story of England and England doing well, and it was, you know, though it was taken up in Britain, it was the story about England going through, and England had been the kind of perennial failures really up to then. It was a bit of a standing joke, wasn't it? And then suddenly we had this team that we liked that seemed to be achieving something as well. But again, you know, you remember in the run-up to the tournament, you know, opinion was divided on Bobby Robson as England manager, which a lot of the time is forgotten now. You know, the mythology that's grown up around Robson is that everybody loved him, and he was a very lovable, influential and successful character. But there was huge controversy around, and it wasn't just the press that were after him as well. And I think that there were lots of stories that people that are into football kind of got connected to, and then they started spreading out and becoming more mainstream stories. And, you know, the obvious one was Gazza, that, you know, that if ever there was a script written for a character that gets the popular imagination, it was Gazza in that run for England. And he'd already been established as a little bit of a kind of a minor pop celebrity, hadn't he, before that tournament. So I think it was a bit of a combination of things. But I think it surprised us all. And I think anybody who looks back now and says, well, yeah, of course, see that coming. There's no way we could see it coming, even after the run had finished and the country had been absolutely consumed by it, it was back to normal. And what Jeff said was right, you know, it was still seen as the, you know, the famous Sunday Times thing, a slum game watched by slum people. But Ad Hills, politically, things weren't that fantastic, and I'm giving my own prejudices away now, but 1990 wasn't a particularly good time as well. You know, we were quite a long way off the change around, and the whole kind of New Britain and New Labour thing and all that went off. So in a way, you could say that people were looking for something to be happy about and to be cheerful about.
Yeah, but I think, picking up on your point, a huge amount of revisionism has kind of happened sort of since then. Well, for football fans like us going into the tournament, knowing that we were going to see kind of these big name players from across the globe, it was our thing. But in terms of connecting with the general public, the England team going into the tournament were getting absolute pelters from everywhere. Yeah. Bobby Robson had, you know, kind of, I think in the eyes of the tabloid press, had overstayed his welcome by at least 2 years. You know, you had the hangover from a really dreadful campaign in 1988 at the European Championships, where England just hadn't sort of performed, hadn't turned up at all. And they had really limped through to qualification for Italia 90. So from that perspective, although we kind of, you know, in sort of our two clubs, from my side of things, from Newcastle and from Morton with Spurs, we, you know, we knew Gazza. We knew Gazza very well. We knew what he was kind of capable of, and we knew that there was a potential for this to kind of be his tournament. But the expectation level for the England team, you know, going into this tournament was just absolutely kind of non-existent. You know, there was nothing there. And I think the other thing as well, it's very easy to kind of look back on the tournament and sort of think, do you know what? England was sort of brilliant throughout. But they weren't. They really weren't. I mean, that first game against the Irish was just horrible by any measure. The game against the Dutch, and I know we're going to talk about the Dutch, was, you know, it was entertaining, but it was still a goalless draw. And even in the last game that England had to win to get out of the group, they didn't exactly sort of pull up any, you know, kind of really pull up any trees getting past Egypt. And if we even look moving into the next stages, there were issues and faults with each of the games that they played. And perhaps the only game that England were really quite dominant in for huge periods, and, you know, kind of the one that you look back and sort of think, yeah, that was the one that you really probably deserved to win, was the game that they actually lost, which was the semi-final against Germany. So throughout the tournament, it never kind of felt as if it was, it almost felt like a little bit of a surreal tournament watching it in this country from an England perspective, because you were constantly nervous. This was uncharted territory. It was almost like we shouldn't be here. And how are we still kind of here? Looking back now, you can go back and watch some of the games and think, yeah, there were some really good performances, but it never quite felt like that at the time. So I can understand tapping into the zeitgeist and how it started to pull people in, because it probably became more of a talking point that I can't believe England have kind of got this far. And it, you know, that sort of thing, people who wouldn't normally tap into kind of football would be like sort of reaching out to them. and yeah, sowing the seeds for what would follow with the Premier League in years to come.
I think that's right, and I think it's an interesting contradiction, isn't it? Because there, I think, you know, it always in a tournament, and it has been blown up a lot more now, and, you know, the press to an extent reflects what's out there, but I think that there was that whole England should do well because they're England kind of arrogant attitude from a lot of the press, but from a lot of us fans, we kind of just thought that, you know, we're a bit rubbish, aren't we? We've not been that good for very long, and you're exactly right, Jeff, that it was part of that story. The contradiction was the arrogance and the assumption that England should do well. Whereas I think the reason that a lot of us liked it was because we were basically doing the old cliche of backing the underdog and seeing the underdog doing really well. And that sentence that he used about, you know, that blimey, we're actually doing quite well after all, this is a bit of a surprise. I think that really pulled us in. And I think some of that enthusiasm rubbed off on other people, and they started, you know, it's like, you know, there's a big noise going over there, what's all that about? I think I'm going to go over and have some of that. Looks like people are enjoying themselves. And I think that's what spread it a bit. I think the other thing that's often forgotten as well, and don't accuse me of club bias here, because Gazza was the great character, but also we had Lineker in the team, and Lineker was the kind of Roy the Rovers figure, wasn't he? And he was also another footballer who could appeal to people beyond the game, because there was that kind of clean-cut, sporting, nice chap image, and, you know, successful, and, you know, scored lots of goals and all the rest of it, and did what, you know, people think footballers should do. It was that kind of Roy the Rovers cliche. So you had those two characters there who were, you know, if you want to argue with the word likeable, you can say they certainly attracted attention, and people were interested in them because of who they were.
Right, back to the football now, and we had two games. Group E kicked off with Belgium 2, South Korea 0 in Verona, while in Palermo, the much-fancied Dutch stuttered to a 1-1 draw with Egypt in the troublesome-looking Group F. So, let's begin with Belgium, shall we? Their group consisted of perennial underachievers Spain and the tough, uncompromising Uruguayans, but neither of those were insurmountable, and Belgium would have expected to get through that group given their squad was made up of a significant number of players that had reached the semis at Mexico 1986. And of course, manager Guy Thys had overseen their first golden generation, if you like, for all but 8 months of the previous 14 years. Guys, Belgium, for a long time in the 70s and 80s, they punched above their weight at international and club level, hadn't they?
I think they had. I mean, the Belgian League was one of the, threw up some of the toughest opponents. You talked to some of the players from the early 80s, for example, and some of the players that I interviewed for a book I did called The Boys from White Hart Lane about the early 80s Spurs team years ago. They said that the UEFA Cup was probably the toughest competition in terms of the, you know, the spread of talent that went across there. And of course, there was that great Anderlecht team that were there through the 80s. And we knew, you know, a number of Belgian players. We were lucky enough to have a couple of Belgians play at Spurs and became kind of crowd favourites as well. And I think that there was that kind of, you know, that started to garner a little bit of attention into what a team like. And, you know, you mentioned the first golden generation, and again, that's become a bit of a cliche. You know, various Belgian teams have been described as another golden generation. But in some respects, there's a lot of parallels with the Dutch there as well, that, you know, there's a group of players that people expected to do well, and then something happened. But I think one of the points of interest for, you know, that us kind of niche elitists, if you like, was that, you know, we get to see this Belgian team, and we get to see some of these players, and, you know, we get to see what they're made of on the international stage. And that was a real point of interest for us.
Yeah, I think I'd go along with that. The Belgian side at Italia 90 was well drilled. They weren't necessarily a team with a huge amount of kind of household names in there, but they were, you know, kind of consistent. The right experience was in the right positions. You had a very well drilled back line. I'm pretty sure, looking back, that a lot of the players kind of in the defensive positions had been picked up from Mechelen, and they had enjoyed quite a bit of success, not sort of Anderlecht level, but I think they'd won the cup in Belgium a couple of times in the late 80s, and they had kind of became a number of those players had kind of become the mainstay of the defence. And then from that, you just had a team, not necessarily of flamboyant individuals or anything like that. I don't want to say workmanlike, because they were a lot more than that, absolutely. Just very skilled operators in different positions who went out, knew the jobs, and then you had you know, kind of maybe the real maverick talent in there in Enzo Shifu, who, you know, kind of had a real reputation kind of going into the tournament and was well fancied as well. And ultimately, looking back, and I've watched the game against England a couple of times, and of course everything is all about David Platt's kind of late winner, but the Belgians played some excellent football in that, and they were really unlucky. And they were a team that, you know, on reflection, they may well have been capable of going all the way. Everything was kind of there. They just didn't get that break against England to take them forward. But at this particular stage in the game that we're looking at, it was kind of, you know, everybody doing what they need to do and doing it well. And they looked okay.
And let's be honest about South Korea. Very little was known about them outside of Asia. But they have qualified for every World Cup final since. And now their players are scattered around top clubs in Europe now, aren't they? Obviously with Son at Tottenham for you, Martin. So these guys were blazing a trail for sure.
Yeah, I was looking at, I had a little check of this on Wikipedia earlier, just to kind of see the makeup of the squad, because I wasn't sure whether Shaboom Kuhn, who had been such a revelation in Germany throughout the 1980s, with Eintracht Frankfurt and later with Bayer Leverkusen as well, whether he was still in the squad. And he had actually retired in 1989, so wasn't in there. The squad itself was made up entirely of home-based players. There wasn't anybody in the group at that stage who had actually moved abroad. One of the strikers, Wang, who had been absolutely prolific in qualifying and for his national team for a number of years, did actually move over to Germany following Italia 90. So he looked as if he was maybe going to be one of these trailblazers, but I don't think he got beyond the second tier and wasn't able to actually crack the Bundesliga. But again, consistency, that was it. You know, they had qualified previously, they were there again. There weren't necessarily any stars in the group, but it's a solid group, a solid side.
And I think the difference then was that even those of us that like to think that we were fairly kind of sophisticated, vain internationalist types, I think we had this kind of idea in the back of our head that you had football nations and you had nations that weren't really football nations. And South Korea came firmly in that they're not really a football nation camp, which is kind of tremendously arrogant and ignorant, really. And it wasn't a kind of like an intentional, it wasn't a kind of a xenophobic thing. It was just that was the almost the thing that we've been conditioned to believe, that some countries play football and other countries don't. So, and, you know, again, what was good about that tournament was that you got to see something that you hadn't seen before. And if you were interested in the game, you know, the cliche about being a student of the game or whatever, that you wanted to see the game played in a different way, you wanted to see different interpretations, different applications as well. And now, as you said right at the start, Mark, you go into any major tournament and everybody pretty much knows who the players are in the teams and what they play like. There's no stars that particularly emerge, there's no unknowns. And one of the great pleasures of World Cups, you know, probably before 1990, was that you would sit and settle in for your tournament and think, you know, we're going to discover we're going to find out something I didn't know before. You know, we're going to discover some players we haven't heard about, and that was a fantastic thing. I think we all fancy ourselves a little bit as a bit of a scout, but it was just a pleasure of seeing somebody emerge, and the pleasure of the new. You know, that's often underestimated, isn't it? Because everything does seem kind of quite samey now, and there is that search for a new sensation and a new experience. So I think that was the fascination with South Korea, but it was a challenge to that attitude about who is a football nation and who wasn't. And I think that probably started to change from that tournament as well, because maybe, say, that's when the world started becoming a bit of a smaller place, maybe started becoming more connected.
Well, in terms of connecting with unknowns, the tournament was completely set up from the Argentina-Cameroon game, the opening match. Now, Dave Hartrick, who used to be my co-editor in bed with Maradona, he, like me, and I found that we weren't alone in this, we were still able to reel off the entire Cameroon squad almost kind of 30 years later. And yet going into that tournament, we didn't know any of them at all. of course, you had Roger Meehan there, who was the star, who was the focal point. But I can't think of a World Cup before or since where I've picked out players from lots of different nations that I didn't necessarily kind of know before. Of course, we didn't have access to these players, but a lot of them have kind of resonated. You had players like Tony Polster with Austria, Marius Lacatoush, I can remember, for Romania. And just about every single side, if I go back and I look at the different teams that competed at Italia 90, it is the one World Cup where I can more or less, I might not be able to give you the starting 11 for every single game, but I'll probably give you five or six different players. And I kind of had no right, if you like, to know any of those. It's not as if I could have done any kind of online research about these players beforehand. I certainly hadn't seen them on television. At that stage, I think I might have been buying World Soccer magazine, so there would have been the odd name. But even then, it was just kind of the big names that you were picking out. And some of these different nations, these kind of outbreak stars for lots of different countries, it was fantastic. And I think I still go into World Cups now thinking, who is it I'm going to see? Who is going to excite me in this tournament? Who have I not heard about before? It's very difficult these days because everybody's got an angle. And most people will be able to give you chapter and verse on certain players probably since they're about 14 or 15. But it is still the way that I consume World Cups these days, is kind of, do you know what, who is really going to step up and stand out here?
Now, talking about standout moments though, Jeff, and that I know you've covered this, but that Cameroon Argentina game was, you know, that's often forgotten, and that really kicked it off with a bang. And it did make people sit up and take notice. And I remember it because I think it was the first time I ever won a bet on football. I tend not to bet. I think you're so lucky. I remember going in and putting some money on Cameroon. I just had a hunch that they were going to win it. And the bookie smirked at me as I put the money down. And I went back in to pick it up the next day. And I've never seen a man look so pissed off doing his job in my life. So that was quite a good start for that. But that made people sit up and take notice. And maybe it sent the signal out that this is a little bit different. You know, so you had Nessun Dorma, that's a bit different. Now you've had this big upset. And of course, at the time, everybody was talking about the Argentinians, weren't they? And a certain player. So, yeah, interesting time.
Mm. Well, yeah, and again, I start to wonder about revisionism again. My recollection at the time was that the tournament as a whole was slated by your experts, your commentators. People like Brian Glanville were absolutely scathing about the standard of football that he'd seen during Italia 90, and this was kind of dreadful. So it's marvellous the way it is sort of, you know, kind of matured and improved over the years with age, to the point that the fact that we're having this conversation now about a tournament that at the time, although it was very good watching it from an England perspective, more seasoned football watchers we're kind of thinking, you know, this is New Mexico 1970, this is dirge, this is rubbish. But perhaps maybe it is more the cultural side of things that's resonated that little bit more.
Well, this game went to the form book. Belgium dominated, although it did take them until the second half to turn that pressure into goals. And I had totally forgotten until I watched the highlights of the game recently how absolutely brilliant the two goals by Mark de Griese and Michel de Wolf were. Have you guys seen those recently?
Yeah, I caught up with them on YouTube, and I must admit I was exactly the same. These were goals that I didn't remember. And if anybody listening gets the chance to, it, you know, just even just for the purposes of kind of off the back of this podcast, of this episode, they are worth checking out. Absolutely suspect goalkeeping for the first, but nothing wrong with the second one at all from De Wolf, which was a beauty. But at the same time, I can't help but thinking that it was one of these ones where he's kind of looked and thought, do you know what, this goalkeeper is not up to scratch and I'm going to have a pop. And I think there was a little bit of that about the second goal.
Well, I think De Wolf's goal was actually his only international goal.
Yeah, that might be right. I'm fairly sure. I might need to check this. I have a feeling he was kind of one of the players who ended up at Marseille, but not at the point that things were kind of happening when Chris Waddle was there. It was, I'm pretty sure he was kind of one of the first signings that they made after everything had been kind of all the revelations under Bernard Tapie, all of that came out and they were demoted. I have a feeling he was kind of, while there was this huge exodus of the stars that they had, everybody was kind of moved on. I have a feeling he was kind of the one incoming player later on in his career that just seems to stick in my mind that.
Well, as Jeff said there, if you get a chance to go on YouTube, look out for Mark de Greece's, I don't know, 35-yard lob over the goalkeeper who shouldn't have been in no man's land in the first place, and then Michel de Wolf's cracking 25-yarder into the top corner. Before we tackle the meaty subject of the Dutch, a quick word about their opponents, Egypt. Their first World Cup final since 1934. They'd had a poor African Cup of Nations a few months prior to Italia 90, and they were eliminated after three losses in the group stage. But as this draw and battling performance suggested, they were no pushovers. Several of their players moved to European clubs after the tournament, most notably the twins Ibrahim and Hossam Hassan, who both moved to PAOK in Greece. The latter is still their highest ever goal scorer with 69. Cameroon had demonstrated to other supposed lesser nations that they could live with the big boys, and Egypt followed their example in this game.
Yeah, they did, and I think, again, you know, notwithstanding what I said earlier, there was a bit of conversation ahead of this tournament about what was seen as the emergence, you know, very Western European-orientated tournament of the African nations on the world stage. And I think that probably Egypt were one of the first teams that, that people... who were kind of mainly centred on European football, did start picking up on, you know, they, because obviously of the success that they'd had over the years, there was a start of a bit of movement of players into European clubs as well. And I think people were interested to see what they were made of at that level as well. And I certainly remember, you know, us when we were going through and saying, you know, what games were we going to watch and where we were going to watch them, we were picking out Egypt, and we said, let's have a look in there and see what they're like. So that, I think that was the start of the conversation, if you like, about, you know, Africa emerging as African nations emerging as a major force in world football.
Yeah, you mentioned the emergence of the two players that you picked out there, Ibrahim and Hossam Hassan, who, yeah, probably took some of the plaudits, but the one player that really stuck in my mind, even at the time, was Hani Ramsey, who... I think he might have only been about the centre-back, who I think might have only been about 19 or 20 at that point. Now, he went on to have a sort of a hugely distinguished international career. I think he had something like 124 caps. He may even be kind of, you know, if not the most capped player for his country, certainly very close to that. But... He really kind of stood out. He reminded me very much of Des Walker at the time, who was really kind of making a name for himself. He kind of, his playing style was very similar. And understandably, there was a lot of interest from the Italian clubs, players that were kind of starting to emerge. In fact, that's one thing that's kind of always bothered me. During Italia 90, and this kind of went on for quite a few World Cups before and since, one particular player... Just say, for example, the Ramsey, who I've kind of mentioned, all of a sudden there's two or three of the big clubs are actually in bidding for him. And you know it is purely off that kind of this game that has been watched on the television over 90 minutes. And it always used to strike me. I used to think, like, do you people ever do any scouting beforehand or anything? Because there would often be a rash of these transfers during World Cup tournaments, off the back of a half-decent performance or a goal or something like that. So whether it was agents or maybe in a better position to kind of push the clients at that stage. But does that still go on now? Do you think that's still a thing? Because it was definitely happening back in those days.
I think it's almost the opposite. And people say now that, you know, there are no surprises at the World Cup. And if the, you know, the scouting networks that the big clubs have got, you know, everybody is on somebody's radar somewhere as well. There's nothing that comes through, and it's almost, if a complete surprise comes through like that, then people say, you know, what's gone wrong? Just because of the technology that's deployed, and, you know, the business that the game has grown into. But yeah, you're right. There would be people that emerged at a World Cup, and as you say, it was really maybe one or two good performances, and then suddenly it's all, you know, everybody's on there, and we've got to sign this player. So. There's a bit of Egypt-related trivia to throw in, because I live now in I grew up in North London, but I live in South East London now, and the nearest team to me is Dulwich Hamlet. And the first Egyptian player ever to play football in England, a guy called Hussein Hegazi, played for Dulwich Hamlet in around 1911, went on to play for Fulham. So though we kind of talk about, you know, the insularity, there's also these little kind of avenues that you discover where there's been a bit more of a mix. So
Egypt grew in confidence as the game went on, and in the second half it was Hans van Breukelen in Holland's goal who was the most troubled of the two keepers. However, it was the Dutch who got their noses in front just before the hour, to some great relief no doubt, thanks to Wim Kieft's goal capitalising on an error playing out from the back. Egypt stuck to their task, and Holland were definitely frail. One goal proved not to be enough. Egypt were awarded a penalty with less than 10 minutes remaining when Hossam Hassan was pulled back by Ronald Koeman, went through on goal. The offence seemed to take place initially outside the penalty area, but the referee and linesman decided it was inside. Magdal Abdelghany put the spot kick into the corner to send the Egyptians into raptures, and they celebrated that 1-1 draw like a win, and they definitely put themselves into contention to qualify for the knockout rounds in what was a very tough group, with Holland, England and Ireland, who coincidentally had all been grouped together in the European Championships in 1988 too. So Egypt, they absolutely fully deserved that point, didn't they?
They did. Without exception. And as much as anything, for the fanatical support that was in the stadium at the time, that must have been an incredible atmosphere. Ultimately, you're playing the European champions, you're looking at, you know, being out of the World Cup pretty much before it had started, looking at kind of the group that they'd ended up in. But the Dutch, as they were kind of throughout their Italian 90s, throughout the tournament, were just so incredibly disappointing. And when we talk about rooting for the underdog, Egypt, I remember watching that game at the time, and I would always have a soft spot for the Netherlands, but man, they were just so laboured. It was, you got the odd flash of the technical ability, the real skill, but the majority of the time it was pedestrian, it was sluggish. And I think what with Egypt, and I think to a degree this happened with England as well when they played the Dutch, was that they probably afforded their opponents just that little bit too much respect, which understandably is what you're going to do. You know, you're talking about a team that's got Ronald Koeman in there, Hullet's in there, even though he hadn't played a huge amount of football in the previous season. Marco van Basten, you know, these are kind of the absolute giants of the game. But they just were not. It was clear right from the start that they just kind of weren't there. Things were not right. And that was kind of something that was a thread during every performance throughout the World Cup. And I think what Egypt did was, you know, they had kind of tried to defend as much as they could, but then realised that, almost like saying, you know, there's nothing to be frightened of here. And when I go back and watch that game, when I watched the England game against the Dutch, I think England were really a bag of nerves, probably understandably. They maybe felt that ideally they're getting off to a good start with a win over the Irish, and then knowing that they're playing this incredible, like, sort of Dutch team. But by the second half, England were going at them sort of left, right and centre, and it was similar with kind of Egypt as well. It was kind of, look, these guys just, they're not here. They have not turned up. They are nothing to be frightened of and have a go. So when that goal went in, yeah, okay, admittedly, it's in the way that it did, but just what an incredible feeling. It must have been a good night out, I think, for the Egyptian fans that night.
Well, this is a crazy point, though, isn't it? That technically, it wasn't a great game of football. So for the purists and the commentators who are looking at for that, the quality wasn't really there, but the drama and the story. And I think that this is, again, goes back to the question that you'll keep asking, presumably through the series, Mark, is that why did it capture the imagination? And I think there were these fantastic stories, and people that are kind of not particularly into the sport, but could still recognise that, you know, there's something special here. And you had, you know, whatever it was, like the cliched story of the underdogs overperforming, or, you know, there's something that goes against form or whatever. They could see all these dramas being woven. And I think, again, you know, those of us that you know, wanted to watch the tournament because we were into the football and we fancied ourselves as being experts, I think we started getting pulled in a bit more. And I think, you know, with every major tournament, you start thinking, you know, I'm going to consume all of this. And then depending on how it goes, not just for the team that you're following, but depending on what's happening, you know, your stamina kind of goes up or down, you know, with your appetite for what's on offer. And we just thought, you know, actually, I can't miss a game. You start thinking that I can't miss a game in this tournament because what's going to unfold? I can't really predict what's going on. But Jeff's right. It certainly wasn't the quality of the football. But, you know, the story here, and as you say, you know, seeing that support, and you absolutely, you know, had to go with the Egyptians and feel for them. And I think, again, probably quite a lot of us, you know, we had that thing, didn't we, about the Dutch. I don't know if it's for those of us of a certain age or whatever, but there was that mystique and that affection for the Dutch, which I certainly had. And I know we'll go on to talk a little bit more about that. But it was a fantastic night for Egypt, yeah, no question.
When Holland won the European Championships in 1988, they could hardly have looked more imperious, laying to rest the ghosts of glorious failures past. Rinus Michels, the architect of Total Football, stitched together a very good squad that was spearheaded by four really exceptional talents. Ronald Koeman, by 1990 at Barcelona, and the AC Milan trio of Frank Rijkaard, Marco van Basten, and the colossus that was Ruud Gullit. But in just 2 years, while the playing personnel was largely the same, things had changed dramatically behind the scenes, and what we've come to see all too often with the Dutch over the years reared its ugly head again. Discord and dysfunction. So guys, there's probably a whole episode in itself of the problems that Holland had at Italia 90, but let's just sort of briefly list them and some of the things that maybe go to explain why they were so disjointed at this World Cup.
I think you're right on that. It was such a tremendous disappointment, but it's what I alluded to before, that I think you have to kind of recognise the affection that the Dutch team were held in, certainly by a certain group of fans. I mean, I'd grown up you know, during the 70s, and so at the start of the 70s, it was Cruyff's Ajax, it was Total Football, which was romantic and it was adventurous and it was attractive. That went through to the Dutch team. I can remember the first World Cup I was really old enough to kind of watch properly and take in was 1978 in Argentina, and it was on at odd times because it was in a, you know, a different time zone. I can remember having to kind of rush home from school and, you know, watch some of the early games there. And I think a lot of us, we really wanted the Dutch to win that competition, because there was a whole thing that they'd never won a major competition. And of course, there was then that European Championship win in 1988 when it looked like finally that great, great footballing team with all those great traditions were really going to achieve what a lot of us thought, you know, they deserved. And we had really high hopes for them going in there. I mean, you know, I still rate Marco van Basten as one of the best strikers that I've ever seen. He was just a phenomenally, phenomenally good player. So you had your Comans and your Rijkaards, your Gullits in there, all fantastic players. And I think that, you know, maybe it wasn't actually the most sort of discordant and dysfunctional team ever, but I think it was the utter disappointment that we had that suddenly all of these problems had come together again, and the arguments that had gone on at Hitlin. I mean, if you read, you know, one of the best football books ever written, in my opinion, is Brilliant Orange by David Winner. And he talks a lot about, you know, the kind of character and why it's there. And it's almost that there is that confidence and that willingness to put forward your own point of view and assert your point, which has almost been the downfall, because, you know, you can't have 11 leaders on the pitch. You've got to have some people being led. And that's part of it. There's a lot of ego that was involved as well. You know, there's a lot of thwarted ambition and frustrated ambition. So nobody will ever really get to the bottom of it. But I think it was that sense of tremendous disappointment that, you know, that happened again, and it's been repeated many times since. And in a way, you know, if it's not out of order to be too, you know, kind of modern about it, that is what's so disappointing now about the, you know, the Dutch national team over the last few years, that there isn't really that kind of sense of romance and magic about them anymore at all. Not just because of the kind of frequent fallings out of the team, but it's just not really there. It's going to take a while to get it back again. And the only sight of that actually was that fantastic, you know, young Ajax team of last season in the Champions League.
Yeah, looking back, the one thing that I really, to this day, that I still cannot process was that, you know, the Dutch in 1988 had had won something. They had kind of broken that duck. So, you know, that was kind of there. 1988, you've won the European Championships in Germany against, you know, kind of in the home of your great international rivals. and the players, it's not as if anybody was too old. It's not as if anybody went backwards at that stage, because over the next 2 years, it was a Milan side with Van Basten, with Hullet and with Rijkaard that won the European Cup. Although admittedly, the season kind of running into Italia 90, Hullet had, you know, he had that bad injury. I think he'd only played twice in the league going into the tournament. But the one thing I cannot process is how, you know, it just seems to have been such a natural progression for that team to have said, right, we've won the European Championships, we are unbeatable, we are unquestionably the best team on the planet, we have the best players, we have the best personnel. It should have been a natural step, a natural progression to make for the World Cup. But right from the start, as I mentioned earlier, it just wasn't there. And I've often wondered whether, you know, kind of, was when you talk about egos and you have too many leaders, was there a point perhaps where certain players just became undroppable, where maybe there were other players who could have came in? The Dutch season running up to this had actually been tremendously exciting, and I think Ajax had won the title by a point, despite the fact that PSV had been absolutely free scoring. And one of the main protagonists for the amount of goals, I mean, they had Romario there, but they also had Wim Kieft as well, who I actually saw in that World Cup and looked really good. He looked on form, he looked sharp. And I often wondered why, you know, kind of maybe going into that tournament, was there perhaps an argument to sort of say, let's kind of let this kid who's absolutely on fire kind of crack on. We know that our established kind of big players have got a chance of being a little bit leggy. They've had a long season, or they haven't played a huge amount of football. And let's do something like that. And it didn't happen. And I was just looking at the squad that was kind of involved, and it was kind of the same names. There maybe hadn't been a huge amount of refreshing done. I think the two youngest players in there were Brian Roy, who of course moved from Ajax to Nottingham Forest a few years later as well. It was a very good player, very very exciting young talent, and Richard Vitschka, also from Ajax as well, from that particular production line. And I just look and sort of think, well, you know, from the coach's perspective, was there an opportunity going into that where you maybe want to kind of like sort of freshen things up? I can't believe that the Dutch actually turned up in Italy and it just all kind of fell apart at that stage. Things looked as if they'd been wrong for quite a long period of time when you watched them play.
Well, the story is that Meikles Fawley was kind of the grandfather or godfather figure that helped them to success in 1988, and of course had been so instrumental in the early 70s that perhaps was a little bit wary of who his successor would be, and the players were very much in favour of Johan Cruyff, who was only really starting his managerial career at the time with Barcelona. They were keen on Cruyff taking over, perhaps only for Italia 90, but Meikles allegedly they felt that or people feel that he was worried about Cruyff perhaps eclipsing his achievements with the same players, and appointed and was kind of the kingmaker, and he appointed his assistant from before, Thijs Liebrecht, and he was hugely unpopular with the players, got the sack not long before Italia 90, and they brought in Leo Beenhakker, who had been the coach with the national team maybe 4 or 5 years earlier. And his preparations, rather than letting the players rest after a long hard season and letting them put their feet up on the beach, he had them all in some hideaway Yugoslav castle, you know, running mile upon mile preparing for the tournament. And I think that really soured the relationship between an already a sour relationship, particularly between Meikles and Hullet, who were sniping at each other in their own newspaper columns in the lead up to Italia 90. That really just was the straw that broke the camel's back. And you know, there's nobody derails Holland at major tournaments quite like the Dutch themselves, is there? So they didn't really need any more encouragement to do it. But I think the coaching situation was really the key to why this was undoubtedly a poor display, but it never really picked up for them until the second round, the knockout stage, when by then it was all too late.
And that's the great pity, isn't it? And I think that probably, you know, that is, you could argue that was the underlying tension, that tension between Cruyff and Meekles that you mentioned just then, Mark, and that, you know, these are two of you know, arguably the greatest figures of post-war modern football, really. You look at the influence that both of those people have had on the game, and maybe this is a project for it to do. Maybe there's a film to be made about the relationship between the two and the tensions, because it is, you know, tragedy is too strong a word and often wrongly used when it's just about sport, but you know, it's about as close to that you can get, that you think that you know, the experience and the influence and the skill and the pleasure that those two brought, and yet it was a tension between them that you know, contributed, you know, largely, if not, you know, was the main contributory factor to the failure of the team at that tournament. So it's just such a pity when you think back on it. I can't get over it now, you can tell.
Okay, it's time for a couple of listeners' questions now. Firstly, am I or we overstating the impact and popularity of Nessendorma and the part it played in the perceived success of that World Cup and the rebirth of football? That comes from at John H64.
Are we overstating the impact and popularity? I don't think we are overstating the impact. It was the perfect piece of music for the tournament, for the way things kind of unfolded. So evocative. We know Philip mentioned that he talked about the imagery of Tardelli scoring that goal and thinking that this kind of relates to it perfectly. But it was just one of these things where it just absolutely hits the sweet spot completely perfectly. One thing that when we listened to Philip a little bit earlier, and he mentioned about the input that it came from Des Lynam. Now, something I'd heard quite a number of years ago was that Des had wanted there to be, he wanted the opera to be in, he wanted an aria of some description to kind of be in there. But I had been told previously that he had insisted on O Sole Mio being the music that would be used. Mm. Now, for anybody of a certain age, and I suspect Martin will know exactly where I'm coming from with this, O Sole Mio is unquestionably the theme tune to the Walls Cornetto ice cream and will forever be intrinsically linked with that. So it could not have possibly worked, but I just wonder if there was any truth in that. But no, in terms of the impact, the crossover, it was all about the emotion, the word in Vincero, I will win, I will win. You just could not have got that any better.
I think, you know, the answer is no, we're not overstating it, because we're still talking about it now. I think everything that Jeff said is right there. That it was the difference. And don't forget, again, this is not to be pretentious, and I don't particularly agree with why this happened, but it was there that, you know, opera was seen as highbrow entertainment, and football wasn't. And part of the reason that football started to be written about in magazines like Granta and the London Review of Books was because there was opera that was associated with it. And that might sound a bit of a trite thing to say, but I think what I'm getting at is it started breaking down a few barriers. I think where the question's interesting is that it's remembering it at the time. And actually, I read something by an old editor of mine, David Hepworth, who I worked for years ago, who's a big football fan as well. And he said that the thing that people never realise about any golden age is that when you're living through it, you think it's entirely normal and appropriate, and you think it will go on forever. And it's only afterwards that you recognise what the special side of it is. And I think, although we've talked a lot about, you know, it was different or whatever, that very quickly it was taken for granted. That was the theme tune for that World Cup. It was entirely normal and appropriate that a piece of highbrow culture would be married with a supposed piece of lowbrow culture. And that's just the way it was. And it was afterwards that we started saying, you know, once you got that little bit of distance and started trying to process it, it was like, actually, yeah, that was something a little bit different that happened. And as the years have gone on, we've realized exactly what, you know, what the impact of that was. And, you know, maybe we've still got a little way to go on that journey, but I don't think you can overstate the impact or the popularity of that at all.
And the second question comes from at Fergus Young, and this perhaps is a very quick yes or no answer perhaps. If Johan Cruyff had been the Dutch manager, given the squad they had and the opponents that he would have faced during the rest of the tournament, had they not been knocked out, would they have won Italia 90?
No, because I would have had an argument about something else.
Absolutely, and a no for me as well. Whenever I hear groups of players getting together insisting that this is the coach that they want, it seldom ends well. And I suspect, yeah, as Martin had said, they might be going to punch up a little bit earlier.
Great. Okay, so we'll finish off with your piece of trivia for today. Just 4 days before these two games at Italia 90, a young girl celebrated her 7th birthday without her father, who happened to be away representing his country, Belgium, at the World Cup. 2 decades later, she had racked up 4 tennis Grand Slam singles victories and been the number one player in the world. Her name is Kim Clijsters, the daughter of Leigh Clijsters, who won 40 caps and played in 3 of Belgium's 4 games at Italia 90, including today's win over South Korea. He was also her manager throughout her tennis career before he passed away in 2009, aged 52. Well, that's our grand finale. The three tenors we certainly are not, so I promise we won't burst into a crescendo of Vinci Road to round off the episode. All that remains for me is to thank my guest.
Speak for yourself.
Jeff, thank you very much for joining us today. If anybody wants to follow you on Twitter, where would they do so?
Oh, these days I am at Def Jeff.
Martin, thank you very much. Always a pleasure to have you on anything we produced. Where can people carry on the Italia 90 chat with you?
Thank you. It's been fantastic talking to you both. I'm at the highly original at Martin Cloak with an E on the end at Twitter.
And of course, thanks once again to our guest in the beginning of the show, Philip Burney of the BBC. Speaking of social media and Twitter, you can follow us at VinciR90. And don't forget to tune in again tomorrow as Argentina try to repair the damage of their shock defeat to Cameroon in Group B. And we look back at some of the shithousery Italia 90 is best remembered for. Bye.